Suffering is what it's all about. Suffering and how to not suffer. The very first thing that Buddha taught was the Four Noble Truths. After he achieved enlightenment, he hung out for a while because he was in a state of indescribable bliss and kind of enjoyed it. And he contemplated whether or not he was going to try to share what he had discovered with other people, because he had practiced with a lot of other seekers. And he was inclined not to, because it was so counterintuitive. And then he thought, well, people suffer so much. Maybe I can help them. Maybe I can help people end that suffering and find the freedom that I have. So he decided the best place to start would be the three or four people with whom he had practiced before he went off into solitude. So he went toward where he had last seen them and did run into them and gave them the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which is that there is suffering. It's a basic ingredient of human life. And the cause of suffering is clinging. We get just so attached to the way we want things. And we crave what we want, and we are just so aversive to what we don't want. And that craving and that aversion is suffering. And we spend the vast majority of our time in these states. But he had discovered that it was possible to end suffering. And he had also discovered the way. And the way is the Eightfold Path. And a very important part of the, well, all eight folds are important, but one of them is wise speech. The Eightfold Path is divided into wisdom. There are two folds in that. Right understanding, which basically is the Four Noble Truths. And then there's right intention. And this is the beating heart of wisdom. And it's kindness. It's the intention not to harm. And flowing from this, these two things, the understanding about suffering and the intention not to cause it, comes the next three folds, which are ethics. And that consists of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And the last fold is what we do when we come here, and that is practice, mind training of concentration, mindfulness, and right effort. And the right effort, I talk about this a lot because it's putting the practice specifically to the purpose of rooting out the causes of our suffering. So when I talk about wise speech, mastering this may involve the practice, the very thing you did in the last half hour, which is try to maintain enough concentration to have mindfulness of the thoughts that come up and then any attendant suffering. And look and see if you can see, well, what caused this? Why am I having this thought? What am I clinging to? And very often the body will tell us, if we pay attention to it, if we pay attention to the actual feeling that the body is having around that emotion. So the teaching around wise speech, and particularly the four rules, different numbers, but I like four, they are not about being a good person who can speech well, but they're about how not to suffer because of the way we communicate with other people or any other beings. The dog. You don't say go for a walk when you're not going to take the dog for a walk. You treat that dog kindly. And also, the rule is to respect that second fold of the intention not to harm. So you're ending your own suffering at the same time that you're ending other beings' suffering. So for those of us who are part of the Western culture that thrives on guilt and are inclined toward guilt as a major motivator, getting caught up in the rules of wise speech can actually be counterproductive. That said, I'm now going to tell you what the rules are so that you can beat yourself up about not having followed them. No, but please, I am about to go on and say following these slavishly can actually have the opposite effect of what's desired. So the rules are, first and foremost, kindness. That the speech be motivated by loving kindness. And that it be true. Now, truth is a very slippery thing. And the truth is, we very often don't know it, no matter how certain we are that we do. But if there's an intention to not lie, not distort the truth, I think that's the general principle. And again, these rules are just laying out parameters of how we relate to our speech. And the third guideline is that it be helpful. And I'm going to show a little later how we can get carried away with this. It's a good idea, again, not to cling to anything and certainly not to cling to the rules. But the fourth one is that the speech be appropriate, that it be the right time, a moment when bringing up that subject isn't going to be dissonant for your audience. And also that the audience is in a mental space where they can hear it as it's intended. And another important factor that I put into appropriate is that it not be said in a way that's harsh. And again, I'll talk about that a little more. So over the years, I've had the opportunity to observe or hear from people about many different experiences of suffering around speech. And it's led me to be pretty confident that these rules I've just mentioned need to be re-understood. For example, this one of being helpful. Now, I am a fixaholic. I like to fix things. I like to do it around the house. I like to do it with my spouse. I like to fix her. I like to fix other people. When I was an attorney, I charged people a lot of money to fix their problems, and I expected that they would, after paying that much money, they'd listen to what I had to say and, you know, do it. As a Dharma teacher, I often have conferences with people, and I'm expected to kind of offer some advice And it's a habit. It's just this sort of groove that has gotten dug into my mind. And I love helping. It just feels so good. But it's not always appropriate. There are times when I've walked away from a conversation that wasn't with a law client, that wasn't with a student, where my offering the solution was not appropriate. And I realized that I had fallen into what would feel good to me. And it, in fact, resulted in suffering for both me and my listener, because I felt terrible about it. It was a really powerful feeling of regret. What I realized later would have been truly helpful would have been just listening and truly hearing what the other person was telling me about their problem. And I've heard this from other people too. I'm not the only fixaholic, I'm sure. Recently, someone was telling me about talking to someone who had recently been diagnosed with cancer, who was saying, you know, since I got that diagnosis, my life just isn't normal. And this friend who was telling the story said that she couldn't help saying, oh, no, that's normal. I have that. And there was this strong desire to reinstate a feeling of normalcy in her friend's life, when the friend really just wanted to be heard. So following those rules doesn't guarantee that there will be no suffering, and can even entrench us in unwise speech if we do have this tendency or other tendencies that I'll mention. What we need to do always with wise speech is bring our best wisdom to it. And again, it's the best wisdom we have in that moment. All of these examples that I'm going to give of the suffering of unwise speech, it's my intention that you will see that you are not alone in speaking in ways that cause you to suffer. Because I've got all these different examples that I've collected from other people about how we do this. And the wisdom that I'm recommending is that we can discern that, oh, this is suffering. I have compassion for this suffering. It is not our fault we suffer. That's the first noble truth. It happens. It's a part of life. And when we can discern that suffering, we can identify, sometimes, what's causing it. What part of our experience has caused the suffering? And then we can begin to look for how we can end it. In the Anguttara Nikaya, which is kind of a fun group of suttas, they're organized by numbers. They're lists of things. Some of them are very short because there can be lists of two. There's a short sutta where Ananda asks Buddha the drawbacks of unwise speech or conduct. And Buddha said, the drawbacks one can expect when doing what should not be done is one can fault oneself. You can be really harsh on yourself. That's the number one. Buddha's mouth to your ears is beating yourself up about it. And then probably the thing that comes to most of our minds is observant people on close examination criticize you. In other words, people who hear it, think about it, they go, hey, you shouldn't have said that. And I think that's a big worry for a lot of people. It certainly is for me. When I realize, particularly, you know, here in the Sangha, when I put my foot in my mouth, and it's humor that gets me in that trouble, I'll get home and I'll go, oh, what are they thinking? And then the other fear is number three, which is one's bad reputation gets spread about. You know, you all go get on the phone with your friends and say, oh, don't go listen to that Rebecca. And ultimately, one dies confused. Where did I go wrong? And of course, then you have a lower rebirth. So for people who are self-aware enough to have a meditation practice, that faulting yourself is really a major source of suffering. And my experience is that this regretting what I've said can last for decades. I may get breaks, but then I'll be gardening or taking a shower or something, and I'll remember something I said 25 years ago, and the same suffering will come back. Like, oh, I'm faulting myself. I was talking to someone the other day who said that he has that experience over things he didn't say. And I think number one on the list for people is, I love you. Not saying that when that's really what the other person wanted to hear. Practicing wise speech seems very demanding. There's so much. And speech happens so fast. And how can we possibly sift through all the rules and all the feelings that we have? Well, here's the consolation to that. It is a great mindfulness practice. You know, I knew somebody 25 years back who would go around the house and put up post-its, just those, you know, the little yellow things, and whenever she saw that post-it, it would remind her to be mindful. Until, of course, she stopped seeing them. Mm-hmm. But wise speech, if we make an effort to practice it, it's a great post-it. Because how many times a day do you speak? And every one of those times can be a return to mindfulness. Someone else who was talking about the suffering of unwise speech said that there's this chatter that goes on in his head that sets him up to what he calls blurping out something. And the chatter can come from just the stress of the day or something in the encounter with the other person. And I thought he was talking about, oh, that's what causes the unwise speech. But then he brought my attention to the fact that the chatter itself is one of his biggest sufferings of unwise speech. That he's thinking about what he's going to say, how he's going to respond to the situation, to the, what the other person is saying. And it just propels him through this suffering, and the unwise speech is the result of it. And he said that that chattering also set him up to hear the other person's words as hurtful with the intention to cause him suffering. And he realized, well, he was already suffering. So whatever that other person said, that's where he was going to be. And another thing that can come from pre-existing stress, there's a short quote from Rumi that said, raise your words, not your voice. It is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. I love Rumi. He just really gets right to it. you know, this is something I see myself doing, particularly in the classroom where I teach, that the students aren't paying attention and I've got to move the class along and I really want to get this point across. And the volume goes up and the pitch changes. And I can see on their faces that I'm stressing them because the stress that I'm feeling is just coming right out in my tone of voice. But there's something good about that too, something helpful, because it reveals to me the state of my subconscious, the stuff that I'm not being mindful of, that's going on in my mind and my heart. And it lets me know that, yes, even though it was not my intention, I did speak unwisely in a way that carried on my suffering and shared it with the people I was talking to. Another woman talked about coming into the situation with an attitude about the other person. And that will definitely affect what she hears and what she says. This can come from having a history with the person. Sylvia Boorstein kind of blew me away several years ago, talking about a feud that she had with another teacher that lasted for 10 years. They didn't have a civil conversation in that period of time. And I thought, what? You're a senior teacher. You're famous. How can you have a feud that lasts for 10 years? Well, yeah, it happens. And we can develop just attitudes about, well, I know that person. I know what he's really thinking. I've been down that road with him before. And I don't really listen. I don't really hear. Even if it's not the kind of feud that Sylvia was talking about, any whisper of ill will, of attitude, can be its own form of suffering. And the good news, again, is that we can see it when we're meditating. If a thought of, oh, I'm going to have to go talk to that person, comes into the mind, we know what's going on. Now also, if we're mindful when the conversation begins, we might feel a tightness. And that can be a warning bell. Take a deep breath. Come back to the moment. Chill. Recognize you got the attitude. Try to set it aside. So this points to, again, back to listening. Listening is a very important part of wise speech. And if we can listen with metta, we can listen to anybody and not get upset. There's a sutta called the Agata Vinaya Sutta. It's on subduing hatred. Buddha prescribed the four divine abodes as the antidote to any kind of hatred or ill will or attitude, whatever you want to call it. He says, practice bringing metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity in your low energy conversations. The good ones. Just practice. Oh, I hope this person is happy. I know they're suffering, and I wish them well. Or, oh, they're happy. Oh, I'm so glad. Or, this is a tough situation. Can I be in a state of equanimity with it? Just practicing that whenever we can. It's actually fun. I love being able to do that. Well, I have more examples. One I get a big kick out of, and I have to admit that I do it, although I haven't really noticed it before, but now I will, that if the other person doesn't say what I hope they're going to say, I assume that their intentions are as bad as they can possibly be. I just really read into not what I wanted to hear as they're evil. Now, taking all of these factors, the way that we mishear people sometimes, turn it around and put the other person in the position that you've been in, and you will notice that people can be predisposed to misunderstand what you say, even though your intention is good. I went through a period when it seemed like this was happening to me every time I got into a conversation with somebody. My intentions were good. I felt like Mick Jagger, you know, oh Lord. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Don't let me be misunderstood. And this takes me back to the first point I made in tonight's talk, which is that it's essential to know what the parameters of wise speech are, but we need to apply them with discernment. Practicing how the suffering of unwise speech feels, and learn what does make you suffer and what leads to that, because this getting to know the suffering will lead to really usable wisdom, and that will enable you to end that suffering. Thank you.